It's time for Now and Then, a reminiscent survey of the favorite songs of yesterday, coupled with a glance at today's musical favorites, all combined to bring you America's music. The orchestra is directed by Frank Hodek. There are rambles in rhythm with the Swingsters, and our special guests today are the Paul Taylor Choristers. Our first song of yesterday takes us back 16 years to 1922. That was the year that Abie's Irish Rose started its sensational run. The word obey was stricken out of many marriage ceremonies, and in the same breath, hairdressers vowed that bobbed hair was here to stay. 1922 was the year that Irving Berlin wrote a great song hit, one that everybody hummed or sang, a song that sounded something like this.
Evening, lady of the evening, I can hear you calling me. Calling, while the shades are
falling. We interrupt this program for a special broadcast. We take you now to New York.
From Prague have pointed to an answer of no. And now from Prague, Czechoslovakia, Wednesday. The Czechoslovakian government has ignored the ultimatum from the Sudeten Germans. They have permitted the 0 hour to pass without any action on the demands of the Sudetens that martial law be revoked in the stormy border regions. At the same time, it is announced that the government will continue what are called extraordinary measures until order is restored. These bulletins are from the Press Radio Bureau. Further details will be found in your newspaper.
For further developments in connection with the international situation, as reflected from the nation's capital, we take you now to Washington, D.C. One moment, please.
To H.R. Borkage, our NBC commentator in Washington. Mr. Borkage.
Well, thanks very much. That's quite an introduction. I'd hardly dare to discuss the entire Czechoslovakian situation, which all Europe hasn't been able to handle yet. But there is an angle from Washington, at least the story of the way Washington looks to the world. I've just come back from the State Department. Pardon me if I'm a little out of breath. I came rather hurriedly. And over there, things are pretty quiet. I walked down those shadowy corridors where so much history has been made. And I thought back to 1914 when I walked them then, covering the State Department in the first days of the Great War. I went into the press room, the same one we had, and I looked up at the clock as the hand got nearer and nearer seven, the same clock that ticked off those anxious moments in 1914. I looked across at the White House. As the evening darkened, I saw the great fanlight turn to gold. The trees were taller than they were back in 1914, but the view was very much the same. The atmosphere was very different, however. The Secretary of State had gone home about half an hour earlier, but his ear, I dare say, was and still is glued to the telephone, for just as I left, I heard Mr. McDermott of the Current Information Bureau call down to the decoding office and tell him to bring up that code. I knew in a few moments that Secretary Hull would know what the last word was. A little earlier, the Czechoslovakian minister had spoken. His words, if not as stern, were at least as certain and as definite as those spoken by Herr Hitler, the man who has plunged the world into this state of anxiety that we face tonight. I asked that His Excellency, the Czech minister, if the Germans did pursue their course, if they demanded that Sudeten Germany be turned back into the Reich, what the Czechs would do. He said, "We will make every sacrifice. We will never turn back an inch of our territory." That was pretty definite. Well, what does the State Department think about this? Ah, who knows what they think? No man knows the mind of a king, they say, and it's the same way with diplomats. But there is a viewpoint, which we believe they have. They are keeping very close to the telephone, as I said. They're awaiting to see what the repercussions will be. But they are hopeful still that war may be averted. The chief concern, as always, as it was in the early days of 1914, is for our nationals abroad and our property, too. Every step, of course, will be taken to remove those nationals as quickly as possible, if necessary, if war is finally declared. No unusual precautions, however, or measures are being taken at present. Of course, if the gravity of the crisis continues, it may be a different thing. At present, things run on very much as usual. The people are going back from the crowds from the movies. The last extra has been shouted. And Washington, Pennsylvania Avenue looks very much as it always does in the early evening. However, the one point, of course, that concerns us is not immediate war, as far as America is concerned, but this question of neutrality. And that's the question, too, they tell us, that Downing Street and the Quai d'Orsay are thinking about. They have their ears very carefully tuned to Washington to see if any straw is turning toward a more friendly attitude toward Britain and France. And when I say friendly, of course, I mean friendly in a practical sense. The trouble with the neutrality law, they tell us, that is, those who feel that it's our duty to cast our lot with the so-called democracies against the so-called totalitarians, the chief duty, or the chief question, is what would happen if neutrality, if the neutrality laws that now exist, went into effect. Of course, it won't go into effect unless the president considers that a state of war exists. If he does, he'll have to cut off immediately all war supplies from everyone. That makes very little difference to the fascist countries because they can't get the supplies anyhow. But the British and the French need them badly, of course. They can still continue to purchase certain supplies, foodstuffs and hospital supplies, but not munitions. It's very evident, of course, from the public pronouncements of Secretary Hull and the President in the various speeches that have been recently made, that the sympathy of the administration, of the government, is with Great Britain and France as opposed to the totalitarian states, to the dictators, they're called. But on the other hand, the law is there in black and white, and there's a tremendous sentiment in many parts of the country for enforcing it. And that law, as I said before, would react against the Allies. Just as neutrality in 1914, the kind of neutrality we had then, reacted against the Central Powers because the seas were in control of the British and French fleets. Well, the point then arises, what might happen if war were declared and the French and the British were feeling the tide turn against them? Would the sentiment in this country be sufficient to revise or even repeal the neutrality laws? And that question is going to be fought out very carefully. Meanwhile, the terrific pacifist sentiment that has grown in this country is being heard from. They have no official statement tonight, but in circles, in, shall I say, pacifist circles, they urge this argument. We have had and will have nothing to do with the policies that are leading Europe to war, if she is being led to war at this moment. And therefore, they plead, it is common sense that the United States stay out. Of course, everyone is urging not to be in a hurry. And we know, too, that Great Britain is not in a hurry. It is not yet decided that Great Britain feels that the British people, either at home or abroad, are willing to send troops into Europe to turn Europe into chaos again, simply to arrange a frontier. And until, of course, Great Britain feels that way, it would be hard to expect the American public to take such a responsibility on its shoulders, or the American government and its representatives. They will ask, is Czechoslovakia trying to preserve the peace of the world, or is she merely making a military move so that she will have the jump, as it were, on the Germans if they move? And then, of course, the old argument that Hitler brought up himself, self-determination. How far will the United States go to support self-determination, and the plebiscite. I have a late bulletin here, and it's a bulletin from London. I'll read it to you just as it is. The British cabinet, meeting at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, plans to draft a new last-minute plan calculated to prevent war in Europe. This is indicated in instructions issued to ministers. And these instructions, it was stated, call for a discussion of measures calculated to improve the situation. It was emphasized that a direct approach to Adolf Hitler was discounted and that the plebiscite idea was not encouraged. That's the word from London, and you can see that everyone there is working to the very utmost, to the last, to prevent war, if war can be prevented. Well, can it be prevented? Some of the experts here, some of the men who went through the last war, military men, say that it could be prevented if the entire Little Entente, and if the Balkan Entente, should rise as a man, along with England and France and Russia, and if Czechoslovakia, in the first place, has not fallen. On the other hand, of course, if the German army marches in to Czechoslovakia, it will be much harder to stop that step. And, of course, that is the consideration. That's the strategic and that's the long-time diplomatic consideration. How far is America concerned in the diplomacy and the strategy of Europe? One of the most difficult questions, of course, to answer is exactly what America does feel. And in the next few months, we're going to know that. But to me, as I look over the dispatches, as I feel the tensity in the air here, as I see the little knots of men seated together, for instance, at the press club, discussing things, and as I see faces there of men who covered part of the war here in this country and who served through, I only think of one thing, not a borderline, not Czechs fighting Germans, but I see men in horizon blue and the cocky of England. I see the Feldgrau, and perhaps in the background I see another tide of men in olive drab. Marching, marching against what? Shattering steel and shrapnel. And when I think of that, I can understand what the diplomats of Europe are considering tonight. That's all, thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Borkage. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to H.R. Borkage, well-known Washington correspondent, who has given you a brief personal viewpoint of the Czechoslovakian situation and its relationship to America. In all fairness to Mr. Borkage, we wish to explain that he came here to the studios on the run from the State Department, which is very near to our studios in Washington, dashed into the studios, sat down, and has given you a vivid story of what's been happening in Washington and what's been happening in the world capitals tonight. And now to continue this international broadcast, which has originated in New York and Washington, we take you to London, England, in order that you may hear Alastair Cook speaking from London, England.
Hello, America. Hello, America. This is Alastair Cook speaking from London, England. London is quiet now with its own deceptive calm. I say deceptive because it's impossible to know whether it is the calm of a town that knows the worst or knows nothing at all. Londoners will awake tomorrow morning to read the largest headlines they have seen on any kind of newspaper since that 10th day of December in 1936 when they lost their king. I can remember no evening in London to compare with this one that we've just gone through since the eve of Mussolini's invasion of Abyssinia. The weekend of May the 21st was another, but that was a retroactive crisis. People in the know at the time knew that it was a near thing, but the date sank into their memories later as the official tag of a crisis. The point is that it did sink later, whereas today, or yesterday, whichever way you look at it, they knew it was September the 13th, and they knew that they were living through a nightmare. I'm glad to say that I can give you no scary or panic-stricken details about the face of London, about the appearance of its streets and its people. Two Frenchmen in a fight might be less disturbed than two Englishmen refusing each other cigarettes. Physical jitters play no part in British behavior during a crisis like this, and therefore it's all the harder for me to try and describe to you the quiet and more intense strain which the people of London lived and worked through in the early evening of this September 13th. I say lived through, as if it were a thing of the past already, and there is enough reason to hope that is exactly what it is. Let me try and sketch for you the general pattern of this crisis as it seemed to anybody in London who just walked around or ran his business and talked over counters and telephones and bought the special editions as they were cried about the streets. We got up yesterday to the summaries of Hitler's speech. You all know by this time that it was a fierce speech, but it did not seem here to be quite as uncompromising as the Führer's harsh voice can make any human sentence sound. The cabinet was meeting, and some of them went smiling into Downing Street. The British have a firm faith in the way their ministers walk into number 10, and there were cheers for the Premier and good order among a crowd of well over 1,000 people. By noon, the early editions of the evening papers were already leaving Hitler's name off the large posters, which all newsboys in London carry in front of them. The name Rodeo was there. It was the favorite in the horse race in Warwickshire, and it won. By the time English officers had stopped to take their immemorial tea, the posters flared out with the news of the killing of Sudeten Ghilman. We heard that a state of emergency had been declared in 8 Sudeten districts. But we also heard that Major Sutton Pratt, a British observer is the word, was already investigating in 2 districts. And the only thing we knew of Downing Street was that Mr. Chamberlain had seen the leader of the opposition and the leader of the traditional Liberal Party. Then the news came through that the Sudeten had issued an ultimatum. It wasn't in the papers yet, but when I mentioned it in some excitement to an elevator man, he scorned the idea that the British didn't know all about it. He said, "We're not as daft as we like to let foreigners think." It was a good sentence, and it seems tonight that the fate of Europe depends on its being a true one. The word ultimatum hit the headlines, and for the first time, the word ultimatum was used by writers. Over the radio, the British heard no more, and possibly a good deal less, than you have heard. They heard that the Carlsbad 8 points, to attain which the Sudetens have rebelled and rioted since March, had been abandoned even as a basis for any discussion. They heard that Nazis had thrown up barricades near Carlsbad. They heard that 7 Czechs and 4 Sudetens were dead in the German areas. Around Piccadilly and Regent Street, straggling along down Whitehall, people could only take comfort by bunching up in 2s and 3s. At the least sign that any of these bunches would turn into a mob, a policeman would saunter over and come crack with his usual genial air, and they'd break up. We read that sandbags were being distributed in Paris. And from that moment until late evening, the words Czech and Hitler bounced off street corners and buses, came from under umbrellas and summer hats. The two go together in London. As only the word Simpson had ever been handed around this town 2 years ago. It was learned that at the moment the word ultimatum reached Downing Street, there was suddenly called a cabinet meeting, more sudden and dramatic than any since 1918. Sir Kingsley Wood, the Air Minister, was looking at shadow factories in the Midlands and flew back here. At 6 o'clock, for the first time in years, the Prime Minister sat down to an urgent meeting with the heads of all the defense services, Army, Navy, the Air Marshal, together with the Inner Cabinet, which these days consists of the Samuel Hoare, the John Simons, and the Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax. The stragglers along Whitehall swelled into a small army of excited civilians, running, jogging, walking, moving along towards Downing Street. But the bodies were ready for them, lined up there in the twilight like... And for the first time, the crowd was kept from Downing Street. A cordon of police was formed, 2 mounted police posted, and it stayed that way till midnight, when most people had gone home to bed. 4 members of the London Communist Party were allowed to enter 10 Downing Street, leave their plans, which was an immediate convening of Parliament, and walk out again. And the Premier issues a statement later, in answer to the same plea from the leader of the opposition, that he did not propose to do this, but that he would bear it in mind. For 3 hours, anybody who knew enough to be interested knew enough to be something near sick with fright. The last radio news bulletin told the anxious householders that the Czech cabinet was still sitting and had not answered the ultimatum. It was due to expire at midnight. And most Britishers will not know until tomorrow morning that the Czechs decided to ignore it. But what they lose in anxiety and possibly depression there, they will gain in knowing that some principles and intentions of British policy have hardened overnight. From a maze of nagging fear, rumor, hope, and hopelessness, this is, I think, as much as can be said about the prospects for the next few days. And certainly only a dictator or a phonograph record could talk ahead of that limit. First, it is an undoubted fact that the pressure of the Liberals to get from the cabinet a firm ruling and a promise to defend Czechoslovakian integrity is not forthcoming. The cabinet has rejected that as a separate issue. They have so far issued warnings that they could not stand aloof, but they have been only warnings, not statements, that they could not. Britain could not stand aloof if the security of France were impaired. France is here in the name of the country that's been mentioned, not yet Czechoslovakia. Secondly, is the fact that the Czechs have overnight expressed a willingness to meet the Sudetans all over again, to sit down and talk. And most relief comes from the news that the Sudeten Germans propose tomorrow to send a deputation to Prague. There is a suggestion now that Henlein himself might lead it. But your hope and mine must come from what in these quiet, early hours in London seems to be the drift of British action. I suppose that 3,000 miles is easy and bold to strike out decisive lines of action. But tonight showed that British opinion is not so concerned to make those bold and easy strokes. All classes and parties seem to be uniting, beginning to gel, solidifying back of the cabinet's patience and back of whatever its instructions may have been to Lord Runciman. As far as I can gather, there is no doubt here that Lord Runciman has not finished with negotiations. 24 hours ago, we read such sentences as, "This is the ultimate limit." But ultimate limit is 2 words in print, and what the Czechs may yet concede under British advice is something else. There has been no hint or mention that Lord Runciman was about to retire from the proceedings. Already the Carlsbad 8 points are scrapped, not only in the minds of the Sudetans. This evening's late radio bulletin mentions that England sympathizes with the Sudeten grievances, as it grants the stress, the patience, and the desperate concessions of Prague. Britain is still refusing to lose nerve or patience. It's hard to say which of these losses hurts Hitler most. But the hope for tomorrow is in the slight backing down of the Sudeten Germans, which is implied in their condescending to anything so pacific as a deputation. There is reason to think that the Sudetans have been told from here that they can be conceding nothing if they pretend to be outraged at disorder and hold an ultimatum out in the other hand. Tomorrow morning there will be a full cabinet meeting to review the situation and possibly to make British intentions clearer to the general public.
We have just presented a special broadcast from London by Mr. Alastair Cook, who commented on the tense situation in Central Europe and how it is being received in the English capital. This is the National Broadcasting Company.